Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and today we've got quite a range of topics. But first up, something that I received a book in the mail several weeks back, and I thought I just couldn't resist. It's called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. It's by Amy Stewart. Amy is an author of 6 books on the perils and pleasures of the natural world. She's the co-founder of the blog Garden Rant and is a contributing editor at Fine Gardening Magazine. She and her husband live in Eureka, California, where they own an antiquarian bookstore. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, first, I've just got to ask, how does one start thinking about writing a book about plants and alcohol?
Well, first you go to a bar. This actually is one of those books that began as an idea in a bar. I was talking with a friend of mine about gin, and he said, yeah, I'm not much of a gin drinker. And I said, how can you be interested in plants? Because he's like a landscape designer and a writer. I said, how can you be interested in plants and not be fascinated by gin and all the plants that gin contains? And, you know, from there, we start looking at all the other plants and all the bottles on the shelf. And it's like, you know, really, you walk into a bar and it is nothing but liquefied plants in bottles. That's all it is.
I love that. Now, I have to admit right up front, I'm not an imbiber, but when I read the book, just the history, the etymology, I mean, all of it just comes together in a great way. And I thought this would be just a really good interview. So tell me, what is your background? How do you come about your plant background?
Well, I'm a writer first, and I'm lucky that I get to write about the things that are interesting to me. And one book has sort of led to the next. You know, I got curious about earthworms, and no one had written a book that answered the questions I had, so I went around and interviewed earthworm scientists and wrote a book on earthworms. So in every case, I'm approaching it as a journalist. I'm not a botanist, but I go and interview botanists. And in this case, I also got to interview some distillers and some bartenders as well. So it was quite a diverse cast of characters.
So I can imagine in your mind when you walk into a liquor store that you're not just looking at it as alcohol. You're thinking about it as everything else that goes into it.
That's right. You know, it looks more like a greenhouse when you think about all the different plants that are in all those bottles. I mean, some people think that most spirits and liqueurs are chemicals or that they're synthetic. And this is the big revelation, is that apart from the really cheap stuff, which, you know, who wants to drink that anyway, it's actually all straight plant matter. You go to a distillery and there are big barrels of dried plants. It's surprisingly all natural. Considering what it is.
Well, and the whole process of creating alcohol, I had never even thought to look at it. And I had no idea. I've wondered about, okay, well, where does bourbon come from? And where do you get tequila and so forth? And the book answers all of those questions and much more. So I want to look into the alchemical processes of fermentation and distillation and see if you can address some of the different plants. For instance, the first one I opened up, and it's in the book, this is done in alphabetical order as far as the plants, is agave.
Right.
This was probably my favorite chapter because it goes into the agave plant, how long it's been around, and I looked at how the agave is produced. And well, you tell the story because you'll do it much better than I can.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying it's your favorite chapter. That chapter took me 6 weeks to write, and at the end of it, I thought, this book is going to take 20 years if I keep this up. I've got to find a way to, but I did. I got so interested in the story that I did all kinds of crazy research. And agave is one of the trickier plants to ferment and distill. So this is a plant. It's a spiky, some people call them century plants. I'm sure you know what they look like.
But they bloom, they're not every century do they bloom, and they're more like every, what, 10 years?
Every 10 to 12 years, depending on the species, yeah. And the way it gets made into tequila is such an incredibly complex process that really took hundreds, if not thousands, of years to work out. They actually chop the sort of the leaves off so that all you end up with is the heart, which they call the piña. And it does look a little like a pineapple or maybe an artichoke. And that gets roasted, and the roasting process takes these really complex starchy molecules and breaks them down into sugars, a lot like caramelizing onions. Or even like roasting meat. There's actually sweet flavors that happen when you roast meat or toast bread. And so all of that, those sugars get released. And then it gets crushed up and with some water and fed to yeast. And this is the crucial and really ancient part of this process, is that yeast are everywhere, right? I mean, they're floating in the air. There's yeast on you right now. There's yeast on me right now. They're everywhere. And so if you have a vat of sugary solution, yeast are going to naturally find their way there, even if you don't add them. And they go to work eating sugar, and their waste products are ethyl alcohol and carbon dioxide, which is the bubbles, along with a few other things, but I'm oversimplifying a little bit.
So when you're drinking alcohol, you're drinking a waste product of yeast.
That's right. Yes, I know that must sound delightful, but it is true. So anyway, once that happens, you get this kind of low alcohol solution, and then basically to distill it, all you're really doing is boiling it. So if you think about at home, if you've got soup boiling on the stove and a little bit of liquid collects in the lid of the pan, right?
Mm-hmm.
That steam, and it rises up and it condenses on the lid of the pan and turns back into liquid when it hits something that it can condense against. That's all a still really does, is it boils and the alcohol rises up at a certain boiling point, and so they collect that in a condenser and that's the alcohol.
So you can produce lower levels of alcohol without distilling. You just can't get higher concentrations without going through the distillation process?
Yeah, so if you think about it, you know, distillation wasn't really invented or understood until about 800 AD. So until then, no one on the planet had ever had a stiff drink. It was beer and wine, and that was it.
So with agave, pulque was what was first produced. Why don't you talk about the story of how that came about? And I especially liked... you referred to a botanist, Eric Carlin, who pioneered coprolite analysis.
Yes, right. So this is so pulque is a mildly fermented drink that could be compared to beer, and it's actually made in a different way. In order to make pulque, what they have to do is scrape out the innards of the plant while it's still alive, with its roots still in the ground. They scrape away at the agave heart and force it to produce a bunch of sap, which is really what it's doing in response to stress. It's trying to heal this wound, much in the way that aloe vera releases sap when you break it off.
Kind of like a sugar maple?
Yeah, or okay. Like sugar maple releases all this resin. So all this sap starts gushing out, and they siphon it off and ferment that, and that's pulque. And this is an ancient drink that was being made long before the Spaniards arrived in Mexico to see them doing it. And the way that we know it's so ancient is not just cave paintings and other things like that, but actual scientific analysis, including this guy Eric Callan, who was an archaeologist who specialized in, as you said, coprolite analysis. And what that means is, if you can imagine at an archaeological dig where they're finding remains of a human civilization, you also find human waste, believe it or not. So fossilized human waste. And he specializes in analyzing that to figure out what people were eating. And he actually found that he could rehydrate 2,000-year-old coprolite specimens and tell by the smell that they were drinking a lot of pulque. That's how strong this stuff must have been. When archaeologists analyze these fossilized human waste products, shall we call them, they were actually able to rehydrate them and just tell from the smell that it was contained high levels of pulque or agave beer.
And they either have really sensitive noses or there's just a really strong smell coming from that.
I know. You have to feel sorry for the poor graduate students who had to work in that lab with that guy, right? Like,
right.
Really? That's your job?
So when it gets...
Science.
When agave is distilled, then it becomes, I guess depending on the particular plant variety, then it becomes mezcal or tequila?
That's right, yeah. Originally, all spirits made from agave plants were called mezcal. That was sort of the Indian word for it. And over time, it got to be a little more refined, so that tequila came from an area around Jalisco, and what we now call mezcal comes from an area around Oaxaca. And there's even a few other spirits. There's one called sotol and one called bacanora. All these different spirits come from different regions in Mexico, and they have denominated areas, kind of like the Champagne region of France, and they use different species of the plant, and they process it in a different way, so the flavors are a little different.
So a question I've had all through the book was, how does someone, and in the case of agave, decide that, oh, I'm going to scrape out the middle of this plant and see what sap comes out and then see if I can get alcohol from it?
Yeah, you really do wonder that, don't you? Like, who was the first person to try any of this stuff? And I figure it just has to be a lot of human experimentation. And, you know, remember that in the early days of human civilization, that's all we were doing, right? That was all day, every day, full time, was kind of interacting with the land and figuring out how to get food, and in this case, figuring out how to get drink out of it. So I guess there was plenty of time to try a lot of things and see what worked.
Well, and sometimes necessity is the mother of invention, and when you look at in the 1700s in this country, water was not something that people would drink, and so they're coming up with something else to drink. And so you've got apples and it coming up with mead.
That's right. Yeah, sure. Apples are, were always used to make cider, which is just a very low alcohol, fermented apple juice, and using honey to make mead, and using tree sap, like you mentioned, to make sort of a low grade wine out of sweet tree sap. Water was not very safe to drink. And it's easy to think back to kind of the 1700s and 1800s and imagine how polluted the Thames River might have been, for instance. But even for early humans, I mean, if you're drinking out of a river or a pond and, you know, a water buffalo dies and falls into that river, it's not very safe to drink, right? And even when we didn't understand microbiology, we still understood that sometimes the water wasn't good. And even if something's just very low in alcohol, it has enough to kill off some bacteria and make for a safer drink.
So what, you know, even the children were drinking this. So what percentage of alcohol are you looking at? I mean, it's lower, very low percentage, I'm sure.
Very low, sure. I mean, a homemade cider might only be 3 or 4% alcohol. That's what's easy to make kind of naturally without really employing a lot of high-tech knowledge to it.
And so, I found it interesting that what the rest of the world calls cider, it's not the same as it is in this country.
Yeah. Americans are different in that way. We call apple juice, we call that cider, particularly if it's cloudy apple juice. But in other parts of the world, really everywhere else in the world, cider means a mildly fermented drink, which is really wonderful. It's bubbly and it's tart, and it's a lovely thing to drink on a summer day. But it's not something that's as well known here in the U.S.
Well, I wanted to back up to agave because there was one thing I did want to ask. As far as the particular variety of agave that is supposed to make tequila, what happens when that plant is being cultivated and you're getting a monoculture of this plant? You're not getting what nature would intend, that genetic diversity.
Yeah, that's become the big problem, is that by law, tequila can only be made from this particular species, agave tequilana. And the problem with that is that they do tissue culture, so they're propagating them in a laboratory with little bits of tissue, or just taking offshoots from one year and creating new plants with those. So they don't get a chance to breed. You know, we said at the beginning that it can take 10 or 12 years for one of these plants to bloom. So for them to breed in the wild takes a long time. You really have to be committed to that and allowing that genetic diversity to happen. So they're getting prone to diseases, and because they can't breed to, you know, breed for more disease-resistant varieties, it is becoming a real problem. You start using more chemicals instead of more organic ways of farming. So it's an issue they're dealing with. Water use is also a big deal. Of course, it's Mexico. It's the desert. And so water has become a real issue.
On page 8, the third paragraph, I like what you wrote here. You said, over the last few centuries and until the last decade or so, agave-based spirits were considered to be rough products that in no way compared to a good scotch or cognac. And in 1897, a Scientific American reporter wrote that mezcal is described as tasting like a mixture of gasoline, gin, and electricity. Tequila is even worse and is said to incite murder, riot, and revolution.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful for a cocktail, isn't it?
Well, and looking at the different, you have recipes in here as well for creating the cocktail.
That's right, yeah. You know, the subtitle of the book is The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. So these are really classic drinks that people might already know how to make, but my goal was to say for each of the plants that I write about, what is the best expression of that plant in the glass? So if we're talking about corn, that's obviously going to be bourbon, and I think an old-fashioned is the best cocktail, makes the best use of bourbon. So they're pretty standard drinks, but what I try to do is really explain what's in them. I mean, even an ordinary cocktail like a Manhattan has at least 20 plants in it, and I think most people don't realize that.
So 20 plants. So what plants are in that?
Well, let's see. So in a Manhattan, you've got the bourbon, which is going to have corn and barley and a little rye or wheat. And you could count the oak tree as well, because bourbon is aged in oak, and a lot of oak gets in the spirit. So I think that the oak tree counts as well. The vermouth is made of wine and also has a variety of citrus peel, herbs, and spices in it. So there could be easily a dozen plants in that. And there's a dash of Angostura bitters, and bitters also, you know, easily contain a dozen or so different ingredients, different plants. And then there's the cherry, right? So there's one more. So it's pretty easy to get to 20 that way.
Now, before I leave agave, I do have to ask, usually the movies and so forth, I've always seen tequila with a worm in it. But apparently that's used to cover up bad tequila.
Yeah, well, the law in Mexico now is that you can't put anything in it but the drink. So the only spirit that you could put a worm in now is mezcal. And not everybody does it. Not all mezcal contains it. And it's sort of a gimmicky, touristy thing to do. And it's really looked down upon by the really fine, high-end mezcal makers who wish that it would be outlawed so as not to give their product such a bad name. But what it is the larva of the agave snout weevil, which is a pest to the agave plants. And if you do buy a bottle that's got the worm in it, I should tell you that studies have been done that show that a little worm DNA is evenly distributed throughout the bottle. So even if you don't drink the worm, there is a little worm in every sip.
but typically, those are in mezcal. That's just not going. It's not good. It's not a good product. It's.
It's usually not the good stuff. It's a gimmicky thing, and the people who are making the good stuff don't bother with it.
Well, I wanted to go a little bit in depth then into what you call the oldest living organism.
Ah, yeast.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, because I'm thinking if you're making this product and there's yeast floating all around. I mean, there are different strains of yeast, so you could have a different flavor depending on which yeast happens to cultivate what you're creating.
You could. That's exactly right. Yeah. So the way yeast gets to be our oldest domesticated organism is by accident. You know, the yeast that do best for wine, for turning wine sugars into good wine, are not naturally found on grapevines. They're naturally found on oak trees. And the best guess is that what was happening was that either grapevines were climbing up oak trees, and so when the grapes were harvested, this yeast was nearby, or that maybe people were harvesting acorns from oak trees and grapes at about the same time using the same baskets, and so that yeast just got integrated into winemaking equipment. But that's how these different strains come about, is that they live on the equipment. They live in the barn or the distillery facility. A lot of distillers are very superstitious about their strains of yeast and don't want to move their facilities because they think it would disrupt the invisible microbial community that gives them their particular flavor.
Now, the whole idea behind creating alcohol is that this yeast is feeding on sugar. So
right.
When you look at beer and barley, you know, any kind of a grass plant, they're not going to store a lot of sugar. They've got more starch. So how does that process work so that that starch changes to sugar so that the yeast can feed on it?
Well, you know, this is what I love is, like, the more you know about plants, the more you just already understand this stuff. So barley is a seed, of course, right? And so is wheat and so is corn. These are the seeds for the next generation. And so what the plant does is plants make a lot of sugar. Plants make sugar all the time, and they make it for all kinds of reasons. And so what they do with their seeds is they take a little bit of sugar and they store it inside that grain in the form of starch so that it'll last longer. If they just left it as sugar, then it would rot the way fruit might rot on the vine. So they store it in the form of starch, and then when the seed gets wet, which is a signal that it's time to start germinating, it starts putting out little root and a little leaf, and enzymes inside the seed start busting that starch back into sugar so that the little plant has something to eat until it's big enough to make its own food. So barley, in particular, is very high in those enzymes that break starch into sugar. And that's why there's a little barley in all kinds of beer and grain spirits, because once it's done turning its own starch into sugar, it'll go to work on the wheat and the corn and the rye and whatever else is in there.
And that's also thrown in with, like, if you're trying to create a mash from wheat, I mean, that barley concoction can be thrown into there and help that process along.
Help it along, exactly right. Yeah, and that's called malting, by the way. So you hear the phrase malted barley. That's just barley that's been gotten wet so that the seeds will germinate.
Well, let's talk about that process and what exactly is happening with that. Because I had no idea. Like, again, I'm not an imbiber, but it's like, really, you have these different alcohols. Scotch. It's where scotch comes from.
Right. So scotch is a particularly interesting one because if you go to Scotland, you can actually see this process at work in the distilleries that still do it the old-fashioned way. So they will actually get a truckload of barley, get it wet, and it starts germinating, so it looks kind of like bean sprouts, you know, with the little tiny root coming out and a little tiny leaf coming out. And they spread that on the floor of their malting house, and they want to stop that process. They obviously don't want a room full of young growing barley plants, right? They just want these little tiny seeds that have only just begun that process, so the sugar has just been released. And as soon as that happens, they want to stop the process. So how do you do that? Well, you dry it out. So they run smoke through the malting house, and that dries it out and stops the little plants from growing. And that smoke is from a peat fire. And so that's where that peaty fragrance comes from, is they're burning peat for that.
Which is why when you think of scotch, you think of it coming from Scotland, because it's a great place for those bogs.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and that wonderful smoky flavor is literally smoke. That is, you know. Now a lot of modern scotch makers buy their malted barley from a malting house, and they can specify the level of peat. So it's done in a more industrial way, which in a way is good because we don't want to deplete the peat bogs, so they can use minimal amounts of peat in a much more efficient way. But it is kind of neat to go see them doing it the old-fashioned way, where they're just literally permeating the place with peat smoke.
Now, you have a page on here about the best way to drink whiskey, and I thought this was really interesting. Just adding a little bit of water makes it taste better. How does that work?
Yeah, that's right. Don't ever be a purist and drink things without water. It turns out that when you add a little bit of water or an ice cube into any kind of high-proof spirit or liqueur, what happens is that some of these fatty, oily, flavorful molecules that actually come from the plants are unstable in the presence of water. They break out of suspension and clump together. So a good way to imagine this is if you, let's say you have some soup that's got a little olive oil or butter in it, and you know how that can kind of glob together on the surface of the soup?
Mm-hmm.
It's, if you've seen that happen, it's the same idea, only on a much smaller level. So once those oily molecules clump together, you can taste them more. You can actually experience them better. So alcohol with a little bit of water added actually tastes better and stronger, not weaker. So you're not diluting it. It's the same reason why cocktails are shaken over ice. You know, some people store their gin or vodka in the freezer. You don't need to do that. Keep it at room temperature and let a little bit of ice melt in the cocktail shaker. That is actually improving the flavor.
So why should it be shaken and not stirred?
You know, I think this is a silly debate, and I tend to kind of shake everything. I don't think that there's all that much of a difference, and some people are horrified to hear me say this. They talk about, oh, you could bruise the gin or you could bruise the wine, but I have yet to see any evidence of any bruising going on.
We've just seen too many James Bond movies.
Right, yeah. But some people say that if it's got juice or wine or something like that in it, you should stir it rather than shake it. And I tend to do whatever's the most expedient for me, and I think it works out fine either way. The only exception is if there's an egg white in there or something else that really has to be made to foam, then you have to give it a good long shake to make that happen.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest today is Amy Stewart, author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. I wanted to look at some of the different plants, specifically monkey puzzle. I remember when I lived in the Portland area 30 years ago, I saw this tree and I thought, this is the most bizarre looking tree I've ever seen. And it's the monkey puzzle. And that's been around since dinosaur times. And it's one that is used to create some alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. I think the monkey puzzle tree may be the oldest tree in the world from which alcohol is made. It's a conifer that's been around for 160 million years at least. And as a conifer, it produces kind of like pine cones, right? These big cones, and there are seeds in there. I mean, if you've ever had pine nuts, then you know that, you know, some conifers produce these little oily seeds. So in Chile, where this plant is native, native people will make a homemade beer from those monkey puzzle nuts. And the way they do it is that they chew the nuts a little bit so that the enzymes that are always in human saliva help start that process of breaking the starches down into sugars and starting the fermentation process. So actually chew them a little bit and then spit them out into a kind of a shared vat. And everyone does this until there's enough there that it can start fermenting on its own.
And that's not, that's not the only plant that's happened with.
Right. That's actually a typical thing to do in South America. There are a lot of, so the monkey puzzle in particular, they call that mudai, but there are a lot of homemade beers called chicha, some of them made with corn, and really a lot of things. A lot of different plants get made into something called chicha, where they do the same thing. They chew it first and then spit it into this tub.
So it's the enzymes in the saliva?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it is interesting that there's so much going on in saliva to break down plant matter that is similar to what happens when you make alcohol. It's really the same process that our bodies are just equipped to do.
Well, this is a fascinating book, and I appreciate you taking the time to come and join us.
Well, thank you. This was fun.
You've been listening to Amy Stewart. She's author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. She is an author of 6 books on the perils and pleasures of the natural world. She is the co-founder of the popular blog Garden Rant and is a contributing editor at Fine Gardening Magazine. She lives in Eureka, California, and owns an antiquarian bookstore called Eureka Books. Amy, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the program, we're going to take a quick break and then come back with our next Petals and Prose segment. Helen Cannon, a former teacher of English at USU and a lover of literature and gardening and who resides in Logan, is giving our next segment on Petals and Prose. So stay tuned.
Witch hazel has long been used as a soothing rub for aching muscles, itchy bug bites, and scrapes. This wonder compound is derived from the witch hazel plant and can still be found in your local drugstore. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Witch hazel is also a beautiful and useful landscape plant. The North American native, common witch hazel, adds a splash of color to the fall and winter garden. The large green leaves turn yellow, and as they drop, they reveal the beautiful, fragrant yellow flowers that can persist for several weeks. This large shrub is hardy in zones 3 to 9 and tolerates full sun and shade and somewhat dry soil. Vernal witch hazel is the late winter or early spring bloomer. Yellow, orange, or red flowers appear sometime between January and March and last for several weeks. This durable plant is hardy in zones 4 to 8 and provides fall color and winter blooms. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. More than 20 years ago, I wrote a piece on Byron Chadwick, who at that time owned and had envisioned the whole of Willard Bay Gardens, except at that time it was called Chadwick's Gardens. And I call this a perennial gentleman because his gardens emphasized perennial plants. I start with the epigraph from Gertrude Jekyll. Good gardening means patience and dogged determination. It is not easy at all. Melvin Dumar, on the strength of a supposed encounter on the Nevada desert, laid claim to 1/6 of Howard Hughes's fortune. Dumar thereby achieved national notoriety, unlikely for a service station manager from the small town of Willard, Utah. Melvin Dumar has long since left that little service station, but his neighbor, Byron Chadwick, has operated the plant nursery next door for nearly 40 years. Station and nursery stand there, strange bedfellows, nestled together at the base of Willard Peak. Chadwick's plants consist of an unprepossessing little house, painted symbolically green for as long as I've known it, a roadside stand, a shed, and a few modest greenhouses. It has been for many a spring my happy destination. Being as I am a lover of perennial plants and eschewer of instant annual gardening, Chadwick's nursery is one of the finds of my lifetime. In fact, when I think of all the trips I've made along this Utah fruit strip, passing Chadwick's by, I feel a keen sense of loss. For more years than I care to mention, I have stopped along this pleasant portion of Highway 89 for cherries or peaches, apricots, grapes, or at Jesse's Fine Pies, the trucker's haunt, now closed, alas, where one could actually get a piece of fine pie. Have stopped, come to think of it, for gas at Dumar Station, and yet have not stopped at the plant lover's mecca, tucked unobtrusively against the mountain. But now I pass all the other places by, the fruit stands, the formerly appealing antique shops. I blithely whiz by the Heritage Theater, converted from a lovely old Latter-day Saint meeting house, and scarcely pause to look at the roadside homes with their adjacent rose gardens. Nowadays, I head single-mindedly to Chadwick's Nursery, and will continue to be the object of my spring pilgrimage for as long as its proprietor, Mr. Byron Chadwick, is there. For the nursery and Mr. Chadwick are, in my mind, inseparable. His is the vision and the know-how. His are the hands. In his 86th year, he has been the one to order seed stock, over 300 varieties this year, mix the soil, plant and care for thousands of seedlings, transplant specimen plants to his model gardens, then label the plants, weed, and nurture them. He has been the one to collect, stone by stone, the uniformly chosen round white rocks for the terraced mountainside gardens. It is he who has trained the 6 women who now work for him part-time, one of whom confesses that before his tutelage, she wasn't sure what a petunia likes, and I'll bet that she learned a stilby before petunia in the process. In the age of hard sell, plastic packaging, single-minded profit motive, in an age that could spawn a Howard Hughes, the ironic juxtaposition of Chadwick's Haven next to Dumar's Station is an unspoken commentary in 2 ways. And now that the fast lane no longer passes through Willard, the freeway having bypassed this route, I have the audacity to hope that Mr. Chadwick's will for a while remain sanctuary for those who pause and for those who want more than a splash of disposable color for summer gardens. In my observations, Mr. Chadwick's plants and gardens, and in my conversation with him in the last several years, something of his life has begun to emerge, like the revelation in the magical opening of a flower. This year, as I walked with him through his terraced gardens, I felt a certain urgency to record outcroppings of his remarkable life. Though I know only the sketchiest outline of his story through his gardens and his plants, through, indeed, his gardener's hands and his suntanned face, I can deduce something of the man. In the first place, without actually knowing this gentleman, I can safely assert that he's patient. Gardening on the level he does it requires that trait. I've done enough with plants to know that, and I marvel over the results of his patient labor. I know what it means to start even a few plants from seed, to tend them once they sprout, providing the seeds have a proven viability, to watch them grow, sometimes to watch them wilt if they miss a single watering, or curl up and die an early death if overwatered. I know what it is to discover that I've planted them too soon, finding the survivors grown leggy or pot-bound before they could be moved to roomier conditions that their young limbs require. I know it's a balancing act to weigh this possibility against the very real probability that young seedlings set out too soon will be zapped by northern Utah frosts known to occur well into June. I know what it is to further miscalculate planting a seedling that seems so permanently small, too close to its fellows, or putting it in the wrong light or soil drainage conditions. I know what it is to see a bed of seedlings thriving one evening and then to discover them devoured by slugs the next morning. Multiply these problems by the number of plants Mr. Chadwick handles, and you can be sure he is a patient man. Patience underlies his well-behaved rock garden plantings as well. Plants, not generally tractable creatures, but like growing children, have minds of their own and wills to go their own ways. In my own garden, the lamb's ear has grown too large, sprawling over the silver mound artemisia, importing a sickly jaundiced look instead of its characteristic silver luster. My bee balm has crowded out the pearly everlasting, and the black-eyed Susans are simply threatening to take over the whole place. The seedlings cropping up everywhere, and the profligate parents towering over the and shading the less aggressive and certainly less promiscuous neighbors. In Mr. Chadwick's display gardens, though, hundreds of varieties of plants grow obediently behind their labels, courteous and well-mannered, amenable as a group of schoolchildren who love and respect and wish to please their teacher. The fact is that these plants show the results of pruning and thinning, of planned arrangement by a master gardener who knows not only their names, but their habits and their occasional unruliness. As I write, I try to recall just what Mr. Chadwick looks like. I remember him to be spry and slim, fine-featured and suntanned. Mostly I remember him to be smiling, his eyes bright and almost mischievous beneath the brim of the old felt hat he wears to shade them. It seems to me that he wears bib overalls, but that could be imagination's pleasure, not the truth. None of this, in fact, is very clear or specific. Perhaps that's because my visual attention has always focused on his hands. I remember watching them, slim and tanned and adroit. A still life of his hands wouldn't do. It is their motion that tells the tale. I can see his narrow fingers as they sift a handful of soil, checking it for moistness and composition. I can see them snap off flower heads past their prime. To leave them would be to sap the plant's energy, so the decapitations are merciful. I see the same gnawing fingers as they tunnel beneath the soil's surface to disengage with surgical skill the roots of a weedy plant. These hands weeding, my memory can bring that into the sharpest focus, while the more common points of descriptive attention are blurred. I am told that those hands have been as graceful at the piano as they are at the garden, but my experience has been only to see how carefully his fingers distinguish the various needs among the plants. His extraction of a violet gone weedy, for instance, bears no similarity to his technique for pulling out salsify, cousin to the dandelion. His fingers work to loosen the soil around the spreading roots and runners of the violet, easing out the whole plant, subterranean seeds and all, rather than popping off the above-ground portions as inexperienced hands might do. The salsify receives specialized treatment as well, a vertical pull of some force to which it yields with surprise, complete with taproot. Oxalis, with its tangle of roots, clings stubbornly but succumbs at last completely to jiggling, unhurried tugging. I'll read the rest of this essay in the next Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon.